Anybody like that?
He may be one of the finest fellows in the world. Yet let him drink for a day and he frequently becomes disgustingly and even dangerously antisocial. Anybody like that in here? Mm-hmm. You betcha.
He has a positive genius for getting tired at exactly the wrong moment, particularly when some important decision must be made or engagement get.
He's often perfectly sensible and well-balanced concerning everything except liquor. But in that respect, he is incredibly dishonest and selfish. He often possesses special ability, skills, and aptitudes, and has a promising career ahead of him. He uses his gifts to build up a bright outlook for his family and himself, and then pulls a structure down on his head by a senseless series of sprees. Anybody like that in here? You betcha.
He's the fellow who goes to bed so intoxicated he ought to sleep the clock around. Yet early the next morning, he searches madly for the bottle he misplaced the night before.
Any bottle hiders in here?
Yeah.
Yeah.
If he can afford it, he may have liquor concealed all over his house, be certain no one gets his entire supply away from him to throw down the waste pipe. My wife is an alcoholic, and next month she'll be sober 30 years in AA. And when we were drinking, we used to buy a lug of whiskey. A lug is three-fifths, three-quarts, 3 gallons. One to share with each other, and one to hide from each other. As matters grow worse, he begins to use a combination of high-powered sedative and liquor to quiet his nerves so he can go to work. Then comes the day when he simply cannot make it and he gets drunk all over again. Perhaps he goes to a doctor who gives him morphine or some sedative with which to taper off. I always tapered on for some reason, I don't know. Then he begins to appear at hospitals and sanitariums. Now this is by no means a comprehensive picture of the true alcoholic as our behavior patterns vary. But this description should identify him roughly.
You know, I think if our government has ever spent anything right in the field of alcoholism, it may be an education of the public as to what alcoholism is and what it isn't. Because of that, a lot of stigma has been removed from the idea of being an alcoholic. Many people are getting to us today before they have to do all these things that describe the real alcoholic. But if you're a real alcoholic, I'll guarantee you, you found yourself in there somewhere. At least one or two of them is going to match you. In my case, practically every one. One in particular. He says if he can afford it, he may have liquor concealed all over his house to be certain no one gets his entire supply away from him. 7 years after I got sober in AA, I sold a 40-acre 45,000 broiler chicken operation. Now, the guy that bought it for years after that, occasionally I would run into him, and sometimes he would grin and wave, and he'd say, "Hey, Charlie, we have found another one." Referring to partially empty vodka bottles. They're behind corner posts, under rocks and hollow trees, falling out of feed bins. Hell, he found them for years on that 40-acre place. So certainly I saw myself in there. Now here's the question. Why does he behave like this? If hundreds of experiences have shown him that one drink means another debacle with all its attendant suffering and humiliation, why is it that he takes that one drink? Why can't he stay on the water wagon? What has become of the common sense and will power that he still sometimes displays with respect to other matters? Perhaps there never will be a full answer to these questions. Opinions vary considerably as to why the alcoholic reacts differently from normal people. We're not sure why. Once a certain point is reached, little can be done for him. We cannot answer the riddle. We know that while the alcoholic keeps away from drink, as he may do for months or years, he reacts much like other men. We are equally positive that if once he takes any alcohol, whatever, into his system, something happens, both in the bodily and mental sense, which makes it virtually impossible for him to stop. The experience of any alcoholic will abundantly confirm this. Now, these observations, the ones I just read, would be academic and pointless if our friend never took the first drink, thereby setting the terrible cycle in motion. Therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than in his body. body.
Would you read that again, please?
Therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than in his body. I can't take a drink of alcohol unless my mind gives my body permission to do so. So my real problem centers in my mind telling me I can drink rather than my body that ensures that I can't. If you ask him why he started on that last bender, the chances are he'll offer you any one of 100 alibis. Sometimes the excuses have a certain plausibility, but none of them really make sense in the light of the havoc an alcoholic's drinking bout creates. They sound like the philosophy of the man who, having a headache, beats himself on the head with a hammer so that he can't feel the ache. If you draw this fallacious reasoning to the attention of an alcoholic, he will laugh it off or become irritated and refuse to talk. Once in a while, he may tell the truth. Now, strange as it may seem, there are times we alcoholics tell the truth. Not too often, but once in a while. You know, I had a lady in Al-Anon come to me one time. Her husband's still drinking. She said, "Charlie, all he does is lie, lie, lie." She said, "How can you tell when one of you guys are lying?" I said, "Lady, watch him closely. And if you see his lips moving, he's probably lying to you." I said, "Do you want me to tell you how to keep him from lying?" And she said, "Yeah, yeah." And I said, "Don't ask him those stupid questions. He don't know the answer any more than you know the answer." The truth, strange to say, is usually he has no more idea why he took that first drink than you have. Some drinkers have excuses which are satisfied part of the time, but in their hearts they really do not know why they do it. Once this malady has a real hold, they are a baffled lot. There is the obsession that somehow, someday, they will beat the game, but they often suspect they are down for the count. Now, there's the word obsession. Now, remember, an obsession of the mind is an idea that overcomes all ideas to the contrary. An obsession of the mind is an idea that is so strong it can make you believe a lie. The great obsession of every alcoholic is someday, somehow, we're going to beat the game. Someday, somehow, we're going to find some liquor we can drink and not get drunk. Somehow, some way, we're going to find a group of people to drink with and not get drunk. And that obsession is so strong that it overcomes willpower, takes us right back to the idea of drinking, and we end up drunk over and over and over again.
So once says malady, and I looked up the word malady here a while back, and the word malady means illness. Once this illness is overcome, you see, the malady. And on page 24, italic writing. "The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory and suffering and humiliation of even or a week or a month ago. We were without defense against the first drink. The almost certain consequences that follow taking even a glass of beer do not crowd into the mind to deter us. If these thoughts occur, they are hazy and readily supplanted with the old threadbare idea that this time we shall handle ourselves like other people. There is a complete failure of the kind of defense that keeps one from keeping his hand on a hot stove. See, alcohol can't do anything to me unless it does something for me. And alcohol did things for me that I needed to have done. And that's all I could ever remember. I couldn't remember the divorce course. I couldn't remember the jailhouse. I couldn't remember the car wreck. All I could remember was how alcohol was going to change the way that I thought and the way that I feel just before I took a drink. A great sense and ease of comfort, which I would get after taking just a few drinks. That's all I could ever remember. Could never remember the bad stuff, only the good stuff. And I was obsessed with the idea of feeling good. Always liked to feel good, you see."
If you've burned your hand on a hot stove, chances are you're always going to remember that. You'll probably never go back and lay your hand on a hot stove again, because you remember the pain and the suffering from that. You know, as a kid growing up during the Depression years, there's a few of you in here old enough to remember that. We didn't have very much in those days. We didn't have hot and cold running water. We didn't have forced air heat. In the wintertime, if we had any heat at all, we were lucky. We burned wood, we burned coal, we burned walnuts. We burned whatever we could in the heating stove in the living room in order to try to keep warm in the wintertime.
Other people's houses?
Other people's houses, if necessary. But it didn't make any difference how poor you were. Cleanliness is still next to godliness. And everybody in the family had to take a bath on Saturday night. Whether you needed a bath or not is beside the point. You still had to take one on Saturday night. Now, I remember one night Mother had heated the bath water on the old heating stove in the living room, put a number 3 zinc wash tub sitting behind that stove, and everybody had to take a bath in that tub. Now, I'm the baby of the family. By the time it got to me, the crud would be about 1 inch thick on it. Mother said, get in there and get yourself clean. And I thought, well, how in the hell do I get clean there? But I didn't dare say that to her. You didn't talk to your parents that way in those days. I scraped the crud back, got in the tub and began to soap myself, standing there next to that old red-hot heating stove. Somehow I managed to lean over and stick my rear against that stove. I'll never forget it. Burned a blister on my rear end about as big as my hand. Hurt me worse than anything had ever hurt me, period. And do you know, I've never had an obsession to stick my ass on a hot stove since. Now, alcohol has burned me over and over and over and over. Just as bad as that hot stove ever burned me. But left on my own resources, I cannot remember what alcohol does to me because I begin to think about what it's going to do for me. And after I think about what it's going to do for me long enough, that pushes out what it does to me. And I think it's okay to drink. And I end up taking a drink and then trigger the allergy and then get drunk. So the real problem centers in the mind telling me I can drink rather than in the body that ensures that I can't drink. I've never seen an alcoholic yet that said, I'm going to go have 2 drinks and go back to the jailhouse. I've never seen one say, I'm going to have a couple of drinks and have a car wreck tonight. No, we're just going to have a couple of drinks and we're going to have fun. And we end up in the car wrecks and the jailhouses. But we can't see that just before the first drink.
That's the trouble with trouble. It always starts out as fun, doesn't it?
The alcoholic may say to himself in the most casual way, it won't burn me this time, so here's how. Or perhaps he doesn't think at all. How often have some of us begun to drink in this nonchalant way and after the 3rd or 4th pound on the bar and said to ourselves, for God's sake, how did I ever get started again? Only to have that thought supplanted, well, I'll stop with the 6th drink, or what's the use anyhow? When this sort of thinking is fully established in an individual with alcoholic tendencies, he's probably placed himself beyond human aid, and unless locked up may die or go permanently insane. Now, if I place myself beyond human aid, then the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous will not bring about recovery from alcoholism, because the fellowship is made up of a bunch of human beings who are just as powerless over alcohol as I am. My aid, my power, must come from a source greater than human power if I'm to recover from alcoholism. Page 25. There is a solution to that condition. And let's see what the real solution now is.
He said there is a solution, only one. And almost none of us like the self-searching, the leveling of our pride, the confession of shortcomings, which the process requires for successful confirmation. And I, too, didn't like it. I come into AA and I saw those steps on the wall, and I didn't want to do those steps. But other people said that they had worked those steps and they had recovered from alcoholism. But we saw that it really worked in others. And we had come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as we'd been living it. When, therefore, we were approached by those in whom the problem had been solved, there was nothing left for us but to pick up the simple kit of spiritual truths laid at our feet. We have found much of heaven, have been rocketed, boy, I like that idea, have been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existences which we had not even dreamed. The great fact is just this and nothing less, that we've had deep and effective spiritual experiences. In the first printing of the book, that little asterisk that's there by that word spiritual experience was not in the first printing. People began to write into the little office and asking Bill, what do you mean by spiritual experience, spiritual awakening? We're doing what you did, but we're not having the same experience that you had. What do you mean? That are we doing something wrong? So in the next printing of the book, they put that little asterisk there and decide to explain what they meant by spiritual experience. And the bottom of the page, it said fully explained on Appendix 2. They put the Appendix 2 in the next printing of the book. On page 47, referring to that asterisk again, it said, for further application, see Appendix 2. And on page 47, another asterisk, and it says, fully explained on Appendix 2. Please see Appendix 2. They mention something three times. They want to make sure that we understand what they mean by a spiritual experience. And if I've got to have a spiritual experience, it'd probably be a good idea if I understood what they meant. And I had no understanding of what spiritual experience and spiritual awakenings meant, really, because when I came into AA, I had the spiritual knowledge of a seven-year-old boy. And I can remember very distinctly one day telling myself, if I ever get big enough they can't catch me, I'm not going no more to that church. And I got big enough they couldn't catch me, and I didn't go either. So when I arrived here, I had the spiritual knowledge of a seven-year-old boy. And they're saying, talking to me about spiritual experiences. Well, the only knowledge I had of that was in our area in the South. They had revivals there from time to time. Sawdust on the floor and playing music and just all day long and all night, just wearing a young man's rear end out. And fall asleep, and they'd slap me upside the head. And I said, if I ever get big, I'm not going to that no more. But anyhow, one night, my Aunt Much, and she's much of a woman, that's why we call her Aunt Much. And Aunt Much got into the spirit of this thing one night. And the next thing I know, she was jumping over those chairs, rolling around in that sawdust, and began to talk in a strange language that I never heard of before. Scared the heck out of me. Well, she was having a spiritual experience. And I thought that's what I was going to have. And I was dreading it, to tell you the truth. I don't think I could do that. But for people like me who are uninformed or ignorant of the situation, they put this asterisk and put the information in the back of the book on spiritual experience. They explained what they meant by those terms. And if I'm going to have one, it'd be a good idea if I understood what one was, don't you think? So let's go back to page 569. Of the book, and let's look at the
567 in the fourth edition. You know, this is another one of those terms that if we don't understand it the way the writer understood it, then the information that comes through is garbled information, just like the word allergy. Most of us get here with preconceived ideas already about what a spiritual experience is. Most of us tie the term spiritual experience together with religion. And if we're going to continue with that kind of thinking, then we'd have a difficult time with this spiritual experience. Let's go back and see what it actually is. And I was amazed to find out that it has nothing to do with religion at all. It's explained very, very definitely back in the appendix. Let's go back and look at it.
Page 569, 3rd edition, 567, 4th edition. Spiritual experience. The term spiritual experience and spiritual awakenings are used many times in this book, which, upon careful reading, and we know that alcoholics don't do careful reading, do we? Show that the personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism has manifested itself among us in many different forms.
I've learned two things already just by reading the first paragraph. One, it might be called a spiritual experience, or it might be called a spiritual awakening. In either case, it's going to result in a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery. My personality is made up by the way I think, by the way I feel, my ideas, my attitudes, and etc., changing me from what I was when I first got here into something entirely different. Doesn't say anything about religion, simply a personality change sufficient to bring out recovery. Dr. Silkworth referred to it last night as a psychic change, changing in ideas and attitudes and etc.
Yet it is true that our first printing gave many readers the impression that these personality changes or religious experiences must be in the nature of sudden and spectacular upheavals. Happily for everyone, this conclusion is erroneous. Boy, I was glad to know that. I thought it was going to be like that Aunt Mush deal, and I was glad to know that was wrong. In the first few chapters, a number of sudden revolutionary changes are described. Though it is not our intention to create such an impression, many alcoholics have nevertheless concluded that in order to recover, they must acquire an immediate and overwhelming God consciousness, followed at once by a vast change in feeling and outlook. Among our rapidly growing membership of thousands of alcoholics, such transformations, though frequent, are by no means the rule. Most of our experiences are what the psychologist William James calls the educational variety, because they develop slowly over a period of time. That's what we're having here this weekend, an educational variety, because we change as we know better. Quite often, friends of the newcomer are aware of the difference long before he is himself. He finally realizes that he has undergone a profound alteration in his reaction to life, that such a change could hardly have been brought about by himself alone. What often takes place in a few months could seldom have been accomplished by years of self-discipline. With few exceptions, our members find they have tapped an unsuspected inner resource, which they presently identify with their own conception of a power greater than ourselves. Most of us think this awareness of a power greater than ourselves is the essence of spiritual experiencing. Our more religious members call it God consciousness. But most emphatically, we wish to say that any alcoholic capable of honestly facing his problems in the light of our experience can recover, provided he does not close his mind to all spiritual concepts. He can only be defeated by an attitude of intolerance or belligerent denial. We find that no one need have difficulty with the spirituality program. Willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness are the essentials of recovery, but these are indispensable. There is a principle which is a bar against all information, which is proof against all argument, which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. That principle is contempt prior to investigation. See, I knew so many things that was not true when I got here. It was almost impossible for me to learn something that was true, because I was already convinced of those untrue things that I thought that I knew. I needed an open mind in order to learn new things. And I need an open mind more today than I've ever needed an open mind.
See? Bill Wilson was like most people who write. He repeats himself quite often. But when he repeats himself, rather than use the same word over and over, he always goes and finds a different word that means the same thing. It seems to me like on page 569, there's one key word that runs through this whole thing, and that's the word change. Let's look on 569. Let's see how many times he said change and how many different ways he had of saying it. First paragraph, he called it a personality change. Our personality is made up by the way we think, the way we feel, our ideas and attitudes. Second paragraph, he again mentioned personality changes. But then he said, in the nature of sudden and spectacular upheavals. An upheaval would be to change something entirely. In the third paragraph, first sentence, he said sudden revolutionary changes. To revolutionize something is to change it entirely. Third paragraph, last sentence, he said immediate and overwhelming God consciousness. To overwhelm something is to change it entirely. Also in the third paragraph, fourth sentence, he said a vast change in feeling and outlook. Fourth paragraph, first sentence, he said such transformations. To transform is to change. Fourth paragraph, about the middle of it, he called it a profound alteration. To alter is to change. So the key word in this whole thing is to change from what we were when we came here to something entirely different. We come here restless, irritable, and discontented. We come here filled with shame, fear, guilt, and remorse. We come here very selfish, very dishonest, very inconsiderate, very self-seeking human beings. The end result of that kind of living, it keeps driving us back to drinking over and over and over again. Now, if we can change from that kind of personality to a personality that's not restless, irritable, and discontented, to a person who's no longer selfish, dishonest, inconsiderate, and etc., then we may find that we have changed to the point that we don't need to drink alcohol in order to make ourselves feel better. And it really doesn't make any difference what we call it. A spiritual experience is what Bill Wilson had, and it happened in a blinding flash. We see very few spiritual experiences in AA today. Most of us undergo a spiritual awakening. We change as we learn. And someday we awaken to the fact that, by golly, we're not what we used to be. I'm an entirely different human being than I was when I came to AA. So we can call it anything we want to. The key to it is the willingness to change. And the only people I've ever seen that fail at the AA program are those that refuse to change. They want to stay sober, but they want to continue living the same kind of life they've always lived, and the end result is they go back to drinking over and over and over until many of them die from alcoholism. Now, you would think that this idea came from somebody in religion, but if you'll notice, it really doesn't have anything to do with religion. It simply deals with change. Let's go back to page 25 for just a moment.
I like that idea of change. I told you when I come, I was standing in the back of the rooms and leaning up against the wall and looking down at my feet. I'd compromise every principle known to man and God. I didn't like me, and I knew if you knew me, you wouldn't like me, like I didn't like me. So I did what most new people do. I looked around the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I found me some heroes. Sponsors and heroes. Charlie was one of my heroes. And I don't like me, so I began to emulate Charlie, trying to be like him. I liked him, see. And I'm glad that I had that opportunity to do that, because thank God I never made it to be just like Charlie. There's only one, thank God. But Charlie was one of my heroes, and I had tried to change to be like him, as well as many other people. But I think the type of change that he's really talking about today is to change from what I had become to that which he intends for me to be. That's the type of change that we're really talking about. Because I know today God didn't make any junk, but I thought he did. I thought that was me. So I need to change from what I had become to that which God intends for me to be. And I'm still making that change. He's not through with me yet. So I've got some rough edges, you see.
Let's now go back to page 25 again. Let's go to the second paragraph where we left off. The great fact is just this and nothing less, that we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences. Now, what did these spiritual experiences do? Which have revolutionized our whole attitude toward life, change, toward our fellows and toward God's universe. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator is into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. He has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we could never do by ourselves. If you are seriously alcoholic as we are, we believe there is no middle-of-the-road solution. We are in a position where life was becoming impossible. And if we had passed into the region from which there is no return through human aid, we had but two alternatives. One was to go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation as best we could.
Step one.
And the other, to accept spiritual help.
Step two.
You know, the book finally gets around to telling us that we've only got one or two choices. We can stay powerless and continue to drink till we die from alcoholism, or we can accept spiritual help. And it seems as though we have no other choices than those two. You know, one of your pet things you hear in AA today is they say you better not talk too much about God or you'll run the newcomer off. But if you notice, the book doesn't mind talking about God at all. And finally it gets around to telling us we just got one or two choices. Drink until we die, or accept spiritual help and find that power greater than human power, or God as we understand it. My old sponsor straightened me out in this area. He said, "Charlie, you don't need to worry about running a newcomer off talking about God." He said, "If you do, whiskey will put him right back in here." And said, "When he comes back, he'll probably be willing to talk about God." And I found that to be true in my own case and many cases of people I've worked with over the years.
My question is, if you run somebody off, where are they going? This is it. This is the last house on the block. Eventually, we'll have to come back here, I suppose.
Now, I'm always amazed when I look on page 26 and look at this little story and see where this idea of the spiritual experience came from. You know, you would have thought before reading this thing that it would have come from somebody in religion. Let's look on page 26, 27. Let's see where this idea came from.
Very interesting story. It says a certain American businessman, which is Roland Hazard, remember he interceded on Bill's behalf.
Ebby's behalf.
A certain American businessman had ability, good sense, and high character. For years he had floundered from one sanitarium to another. He wore out the best known American psychiatrist. His family had plenty of money, so they gave him lots of treatment. He had consulted the best known American psychiatrist. Then he had gone to Europe, placing himself in the care of the celebrated physician, the psychiatrist Dr. Jung, who prescribed for him. For experience had made him skeptical, he finished his treatment with unusual confidence. His physical and mental condition was unusually good. He was over there for 1 year. He didn't go over there just for a 30-day treatment program. He was over there for 1 year. Above all, he believed he had acquired such a profound knowledge of the inner workings of his mind that hidden springs at relapse was unthinkable. Nevertheless, he was drunk in a short time. More baffling still, he had given himself no satisfactory explanation for his fall. He gets out of the hospital after 1 year, being psychoanalyzed by one of the best psychiatrists in the world at that time. He gets out of the hospital, heads to the ship to come back home, and gets drunk on the way to the ship. So he returns to this doctor whom he admired, and he asks him point blank why he could not recover. He wished above all things to regain self-control. He seemed quite rational, well-balanced with respect to other problems. He had no control whatever over alcohol. Why was this? And he asked the doctor. He begged the doctor to tell him the whole truth, and he got it. In the doctor's judgment, he was utterly hopeless, and he could never regain his position in society and would have to place himself under lock and key or hire a bodyguard if he expected to live long. This was a great physician's opinion. That's kind of a low blow, isn't it? You go back to the doctor whom he admired, and the doctor said, "Look, Roland, you've been over here for a year. I've done all I can possibly do for you." A very humble man. He could have said to Roland, "Look, obviously you and your family have lots of money. You keep coming back and I'll continue to treat you. I think you have a Valium deficiency anyhow." See? But he didn't do that. He said, "I've done all I can possibly do for you. Psychiatry has done all it can possibly do for you. You're going to have to hire a bodyguard or be locked up." That was a great physician's opinion.
But this man still lives and is a free man. He does not need a bodyguard, nor is he confined. He can go anywhere on this earth where the other free men may go without disaster, provided he remains willing to maintain a certain simple attitude. Now, some of our alcoholic readers may think they can do without spiritual help. Let us tell you the rest of the conversation our friend had with his doctor. The doctor said, "You have the mind of a chronic alcoholic. I've never seen one single case recover where that state of mind existed to the extent that it does in you." Our friend felt as though the gates of hell had closed on him with a clang. He said to the doctor, "Is there no exception?" "Yes," replied the doctor, "there is. Exceptions to cases such as yours have been occurring since early times. Here and there, once in a while, alcoholics have had what are called vital spiritual experiences. To me, these occurrences are phenomena. They appear to be in the huge nature, and they appear to be in the nature of huge emotional displacements and rearrangements.
Change.
Ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which were once the guiding forces of the lives of these men, are suddenly cast to one side.
Change.
And a completely new set of conceptions and motives begin to dominate them.
Change.
In fact, I've been trying to produce some such emotional rearrangement within you.
Change.
With many individuals, the methods which I employed are successful, but I've never been successful with an alcoholic of your description. Asterisk, bottom of the page, for amplification, see Appendix 2. They want to be sure that we understand what this spiritual experience is. Can you imagine the humility of this doctor? In the times we're referring to here, this is 1930. There was three leading psychiatrists in the world. One was Dr. Freud, one was Dr. Adler, and one was Dr. Jung. Adler and Jung were students of Freud. Jung had fallen out with Adler and Freud on one thing and one thing only. Adler and Freud believed that all answers would lie within the mind itself. Dr. Jung believed that some answers would have to lie within spirituality beyond human understanding. You know, thank God that Roland got to Dr. Jung. Thank God he didn't get to Freud or Adler. If he had, we'd still be sitting around in AA meetings today psychoanalyzing ourselves rather than searching for spirituality. And unfortunately, that's what they're doing in many AA groups, trying to psychoanalyze this deal rather than search for spirituality. You know, this guy had enough humility to say, Roland, I can't help you anymore. I've done all I can do for you. With all my knowledge of the inner workings of the mind, I cannot do any more for your alcoholism problem. And Roland said, he said, you're going to die from it. Roland says, are there no exceptions? This little doctor was great enough to go outside of his profession and say, oh yeah, oh yeah. Once in a while, I've seen guys like you have a vital spiritual experience. He said, they're phenomenal to me. I don't understand them. But here's what takes place. Now, we don't know whether he told Roland to go to the Oxford groups or not. But we know Roland came back to the States and got involved in the Oxford groups and used their program of action, had a spiritual experience, and recovered from alcoholism. He and another guy named Seba Graves took this idea to Abby Thatcher. And Abby Thatcher was using the program of action and staying sober. Abby brought it to Bill Wilson. So the very solution to our problem came to us from a psychiatrist on the other side of the world. Sometimes I'm amazed when I look at these things. You know, we alcoholics who are so proud of our 12-step program, and rightfully we should be so, but sometimes we need to stop and think and see where these things really came from. You know, step one came to us from a doctor named Dr. Silkworth in New York City who was non-alcoholic. Step two came from us from a non-alcoholic psychiatrist over on the other side of the world named Dr. Jung. The last 10 steps came to us from a group of people practicing first century Christianity who were non-alcoholics. Everything that we use in our program came to us from non-alcoholic people. Bill Wilson had the unique ability to take these ideas and rewrite them in the manner that we alcoholics could accept them, but they didn't come from Bill. Bill always said he knew none of these things. And he said, all these ideas from different sources gelled in my mind, and from those I was able to write the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm amazed at the idea they came from non-alcoholics.
See, I think that Alcoholics Anonymous started right there with the solution given to Roland from Dr. Jung. Because he said that here and there, just once in a great while, alcoholics have had a vital spiritual awakening. To me, these things were a phenomenon. I suggest you go back home and find you a spiritual way of living. And, of course, we know that he did that. But today, in AA, today, right now, we can look at each other and say this, that here and now, every time an alcoholic would apply these steps to their life, they too can recover. Back in, in those days, it was here and there once in a while. Today is here and now, every time an alcoholic would apply these things. And they call it Alcoholics Anonymous. And I believe it started back there. You know, Dr. Jung gave Roland the solution. The solution was given to Abby, and Abby would give it to Bill. And Bill was able to put it down in his book. You know, the problem that we understand came from Dr. Silkworth. He knew what the problem was, but he had no solution for it other than don't drink. Dr. Jung had a solution, vital spiritual experience, but he didn't know what the problem was. The Oxford Group had a planned program of action. They weren't interested in the problem of alcoholism or its solution at all. They just had the tenets of the Oxford Group, which they were practicing. Bill was able to see all this and put it down in this book so we too could recover from alcoholism using the best from all of those particular sciences, so to speak.
Is that odd?
Is that God?
Or is that God? You know, surely God used all these people to put this thing together. Surely he used Bill Wilson's mind to codify it in a manner that we alcoholics could accept it. Surely this is a God-given program. I can almost see Bill as he writes the book now. He probably sits down at the end of chapter 2. And probably reviewing the book up to this point, he's able to say, well, I was able to show them the problem in the doctor's opinion in my story, which is Bill's story. I was able to show them the solution to that problem in chapter 2. The power of the fellowship which supports us and the power of the vital spiritual experience which changes us. And we're going to look here at a little picture for just a moment to tie these two ideas together. The need for the fellowship that supports us and the vital spiritual experience which changes us. You have a little picture to match this in your handout sheets. And on the left-hand side of that sheet, we made a little drawing of the fellowship that supports us. Where the older members, through the sharing of their experience, strength, and hope with the newcomer, provides enough power, enough support for the newcomer to be able to stay sober for a period of time. And by the way, it's a two-way street. As the older member supports and helps the new member, the older member draws support from that also. Lots of power in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. It'd be almost impossible to be in the fellowship today and not eventually begin to believe there must be some power greater than human power working within and throughout this fellowship. When you hear countless dozens and hundreds of people saying it's only by the grace of God, or because of a power greater than I am, or because I found a God of my understanding that I haven't found it necessary to take a drink in X number of days, weeks, months, years, or whatever, you could hardly hear that over and over and over and over and not begin to believe there must be some power greater than human power working within and throughout this fellowship. The instant the newcomer comes to believe that, that opens the mind. And they become willing to investigate and see what this power is. And upon investigation and with the help of a good sponsor, they find this simple kit of spiritual tools laid at their feet. The 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And as they apply the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous in their life to the best of their ability, they're guaranteed to have a spiritual experience which is fast or a spiritual awakening which is slow. And that process will revolutionize their whole attitude toward life, toward our fellows, and toward God's universe. In other words, a personality change sufficient to recover from alcoholism. Now, when that happens to the newcomer, they now become older members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they can go back to the left-hand side of the sheet. And they can support the next newcomer that comes in by sharing their experience, strength, and hope with the newcomer. And then that newcomer can come to believe and investigate and also apply the program and recover from alcoholism. And if you'll notice, we're basing older membership not on how long you've been sober, but whether or not you've had the spiritual experience or spiritual awakening or not. You know, our book makes it clear you can't give away something you haven't got. And I can't help a newcomer have a spiritual experience or spiritual awakening unless I've had one myself. And if I've had it myself, then I'm an older member of Alcoholics Anonymous. So we're basing it on whether you really had the spiritual experience or spiritual awakening. You see all kinds of people in AA today. Now sometimes you see a guy that's only been in here maybe a year, got him a good sponsor. The sponsor took him right through the steps. He's had a spiritual experience or spiritual awakening, and he is a delight to behold, he or she. You just love to be around them. They're always laughing. They're always cutting up. They're always having fun. They're always doing what they can to help they and other people. And you just enjoy being in their company. Hadn't been sober very long. You see other people in AA, it's been sober 6, 8, 10, 12 years. Treated it like a cafeteria. They took some and left some. They're better than they used to be when they first came here. But you never know what kind of shape they're going to be in the next time you see them. One day they're up and the next day they're down and they're kind of like a yo-yo going back and forth. Better off than they used to be, but still not in too good a shape. And then you see some that have been in here 15, 16, 18, 20 years. Never worked a step. Damn proud of it. And they're the ones that say, by God, if you want what we've got, that you're winning it. Some of those guys, you'd like to buy them a drink. You know damn good and well they would feel better. See? So we're basing older membership not on how long we've been sober, but the quality of that sobriety. And in the beginning, when AA first started, there was never any question about whether people are going to work the program or not. If they didn't work the program, they told them, we can't help you. You need to go somewhere else because we can't do anything for you. But then slowly, 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 over a period of years, they began to water the program down. And in self-defense, they started measuring success by how long you've been sober rather than by the quality of that sobriety. And only those that have had the spiritual experience can help the next one have a spiritual experience. Okay? Good. Good. Again, Bill probably sits down and reviews what he's done up to this point. Probably says to himself, I was able to show them the problem and the doctor's opinion and my story, Bill's story. I was able to show them the solution in chapter 2. But he probably says they're not going to like that solution any better than I liked it. Remember how Bill had such a hard time with this idea of God that Eddie Thatcher was bringing to him. And he said, maybe I better show them just exactly what's going to happen to them if they don't find that solution. And he sat down and he wrote another chapter, and he called it More About Alcoholism, Chapter 3. And in More About Alcoholism, Chapter 3, he talks about one thing and one thing only. He talks about the insanity of alcoholism. Many people, when they come to AA, they say, well, I didn't have any problem with that insanity because I remember the crazy, stupid things I did while drunk. Other people come to AA and says, don't tell me I'm insane. Yeah, I did some crazy, stupid things when I was drunk, but normal, I'm much like other people. In either case, they're referring to the crazy, stupid things we did while drunk as insanity. No, that's not insanity. The crazy, stupid things we did while drunk is caused by a mind that is filled with a drug that lowers the inhibitions called alcohol. And if your mind is filled with something that lowers the inhibitions, look out. You're going to do some pretty crazy, stupid things, okay. But that's not insanity. That's caused by alcohol itself. It bugged us, and it bugged us, and it bugged us. Until finally one day we went back to the dictionary. And we looked up these terms. Sanity, sane, insanity, and etc. And the dictionary defines sanity as wholeness of mind or completeness of mind. A mind that is whole, a mind that is complete, can see the truth about everything around it, makes decisions based on truth, and life usually turns out pretty good. An insane mind is one that is less than whole. One that cannot always see the truth about everything around it, makes a decision based upon lies, and life becomes an absolute living hell. To be insane does not mean you're crazy. You know, if you're crazy, you've lost more than half your marbles. And you got to be locked up somewhere to protect you and society from you. To be insane does not mean you're crazy. It just simply means you can't always see the truth about things around you. My friend Joe from Little Rock, he always used an example which I think fits just perfectly here. Especially this morning since we've got a pie sitting here. Joe said, let's take this pie and set it in front of us. And let's cut it in 10 pieces. And you come along and I give you a piece of pie. He said, my pie is now less than whole, but I've still got 90% of it. Somebody else comes along and I give them a piece of pie. My pie is now more less than whole, but I've still got 80% of it. He said, insanity does not mean you're all gone. It just means you're not quite all here. And when it comes to alcohol, it seems as though from time to time, we're not quite all here. Can we see the truth about alcohol or can we not? If we can, we're sane. If we can't, we're insane. Now, through this chapter, Bill is going to, again, using one of the best ways to teach, he's going to use a series of examples. He's going to talk about the man of 30. He's going to talk about a fellow named Jim. He's going to talk about a jaywalker. He's going to talk about a fellow named Fred. And we're going to look in the mind each time just before they relapse and take that first drink. Can they or can they not see the truth? If they can, they're sane. If they can't, they're insane. Let's look at it for just a little bit.
I've heard all my life, if you know the truth will set you free. But if I'm not free, it's because I don't know the truth. I spent most of my life not knowing the truth. This chapter is called More About Alcoholism. It could be called More Truth About Alcoholism. More about what's going to happen to me unless I accept the solution that was just given to us. And it says here on page 30, More About Alcoholism, most of us have been unwilling to admit that we were real alcoholics. No person likes to think that he's bodily and mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it's not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy. That's two different things. To control and enjoy. Every time I had to control my drinking, I didn't enjoy it. If I enjoyed it, it's because I didn't have any control over it. You see? It's a great obsession, there's that word, of every abnormal drinker. Obsession means an idea that overpowers all other ideas. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it in the gates of insanity or death. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholic. This is the first step in recovery. The illusion. that we're like other people who presently may be has to be smashed.
Now, you have to be careful here. Because within these two paragraphs, he used four different words that all mean the same thing. And if you see what he's doing, then it becomes clear. If you don't, you may think he's talking about something different. He said the idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. Now, we know that an obsession is an idea that is so strong it can make you believe a lie or believe something that's not true. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. We know what an illusionist is. They're a magician. And they can stand in front of you and with sleight of hand and a few props make you believe something that isn't true. So the word illusion means the same thing, to believe a lie. Many pursued into the gates of insanity or death. Insanity means to believe a lie, to believe something that isn't true. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we are like other people or presently maybe has to be smashed. The word delusion means the same thing. If you deluded yourself, you've come to believe something that isn't true. So we may see him using any one of those four words: obsession, illusion, delusion, or insanity. They all mean the same identical thing.
I looked those words up recently, and the word obsession means a disturbing preoccupation with an idea or feeling. An illusion is a mistaken idea. A delusion is persistent belief in something false, typical of some mental disorders. Number four, insanity, foolish, not mentally sound. All those words sound to me like they mean the same thing, don't they, you? And that's what he's talking about. The same thing. He's not talking about four different things. Just always the same thing, insanity.
Now, the first example we're going to look at is on page 32, a man of 30. Let's take a little look at him just before we go to lunch.
Said a man of 30 was doing a great deal as free drinking.
Second paragraph on 32.
He was very nervous in the mornings after these bouts and quieted himself with more liquor. He was ambitious to succeed in business, but saw that he would get nowhere if he drank at all. Once he started, he had no control whatever. Now, he made up his mind, and until he had been successful in business and had retired, he would not touch another drop. An exceptional man. Now, he remained stark, raving dry for 25 years. I mean, bone dry for 25 years. And it retired at the age of 55 after a successful and happy business career. Then he fell victim to a belief which practically every alcoholic has, that his long period of sobriety and self-discipline had qualified him to drink as other men. Out came his carpet slippers and the bottle. In 2 months, he was in the hospital, puzzled and humiliated. He tried to regulate his drinking for a while, making several trips to the hospital in the meantime. Then, gathering all his forces, he attempted to stop altogether and found that he could not. Every means of solving his problem which money could buy was at his disposal. Every attempt failed. Though a robust man at retirement, he went to pieces quickly and was dead within 4 years. Now, this case contains a powerful lesson. Most of us have believed that if we remained sober for a long stretch, we could thereafter drink normally. But here's a man who at 55 years found he was just where he left off at 30. We've seen the truth demonstrated again and again. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. Commencing to drink after a period of sobriety, we're in a short time as bad as ever. If we're planning to stop drinking, there must be no reservation of any kind, nor any lurking notion that someday we'll be immune to alcohol.
Now, we know the truth to be this: once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. We've never seen even one single one of us that's ever been able to go back to successful drinking. Now, to believe anything other than that is to believe a lie. Is this guy's real problem the fact that he has a physical allergy to alcohol, or that he has a form of insanity that tells him it's okay to drink alcohol after 25 years of sobriety? Based on the lie, he made a decision and took some action. Out came his carpet slippers and a bottle. Immediately he triggered the allergy, and he couldn't stop drinking, and in 4 years he's dead. So is his real problem the fact that he has a physical allergy to alcohol? Or that he has a form of insanity, an obsession of the mind, that tells him it's okay to drink alcohol? The real problem of the alcoholic centers in the mind, telling us we can drink, rather than in a body that ensures that we can't drink. This is one example of the insanity of alcoholism. I think it's time to go to lunch. What do you think? Mm-hmm. We come back at 1:30.
Anybody sleepy besides me? Sleepy. Yeah. Tell you this story about this couple that was driving along the 75 highway out there, and his wife told him, said, "You better slow down, you're going to get a ticket." And he said, "Oh, don't worry about that." Pretty soon the highway patrol was turned the light on and pulled him over and said, come up to him and said, "Sir, I'm going to have to give you a ticket for speeding." His wife said, "I told him way back to slow down, he's going to get a ticket." And he said, "You be quiet, I'll deal with you and I get you home." And he said, "Sir, I'm going to have to give you a ticket for not having your seatbelt on." He said, "Now, I had my seatbelt on. I took it loose to reach around and get my billfold so I'd get my driver's license and show it to you." And she said, "Now, that's not true. So I told you way back there to slow down, put your seatbelt on, you're going to get a ticket." He said, "You be quiet, I'll deal with you when I get you home." The policeman said, "Ma'am, does he always talk to you like this?" She said, "Only when he's drinking."
That story is as bad as the one about the highway patrolman that stopped this guy. And he said, "Sir, you were doing 85 miles an hour." He said, "I've been following you trying to catch you for 10 miles. What in the hell is your hurry anyhow?" And this guy said, "Well, officer, it's like this." He said, "My wife ran away with a highway patrolman 3 weeks ago." And he said, "I thought you were trying to catch me to give her back to me." Let's go to page 34. We've been talking about the insanity. We talked about the man of 30 who believed that after 25 years of sobriety he could drink like other people. Believed the lie, took a drink, triggered the allergy, and he ended up dying from alcoholism. On page 34, the second paragraph. "For those who are unable to drink moderately, the question is how to stop altogether." We are assuming, of course, that the reader desires to stop. Whether such a person can quit upon a non-spiritual basis depends upon the extent to which he's already lost the power to choose whether he will drink or not. Many of us felt we had plenty of character. There was a tremendous urge to cease forever, yet we found it impossible. This is the baffling feature of alcoholism as we know it, this utter inability to leave it alone, no matter how great the necessity or the wish. How then shall we help our readers determine to their own satisfaction whether they are one of us? The experiment of quitting for a period of time will be helpful, but we think we can render an even greater service to alcoholic sufferers and perhaps to the medical fraternity. So we shall describe some of the mental states that precede a relapse into drinking. For obviously this is the crux of the problem. Now remember, just before we relapse into drinking, there's no alcohol in the system at all. We're stone cold sober. What sort of thinking dominates an alcoholic who beats time after time the desperate experiment of the first drink? Friends who have reasoned with him after a spree, which is brought into the point of divorce or bankruptcy, are mystified when he walks directly into a saloon. Why does he? Of what is he thinking? Our first example is a friend we shall call Jim. Now, Joe just loves old Jim. He gets a little screwed up with him once in a while. Let's see what he can do with Jim this time, Joe.
Yeah, I love old Jim. We're going to look into the mind of Jim and see what he was thinking just before he took a drink. This man has a charming wife and family. He inherited a lucrative automobile agency. He had a commendable World War record. He's a good salesman. Everybody likes him.
Typical alcoholic, isn't he? Yeah.
And he's an intelligent man and normal so far as we can see, except for a nervous disposition. He did no drinking until he was 35. In a few years, he became so violent when intoxicated that he had to be committed. On leaving the asylum, well, it's the same thing.
Same thing, just got a different name for him today.
He came into contact with us. Now, we told him what we knew of alcoholism.
They told him about step one.
And the answer we'd found.
They told him about step two.
And he made a beginning.
Later on, we're going to see where step three is but a beginning. So apparently, Jim took steps one, two, and three. Things immediately started getting better for him.
Good things happened to him. His family was reassembled. He began to work as a salesman for a business he'd lost through drinking. And all went well for a time, but he failed to enlarge his spiritual life.
Later on, we're going to see the only way we enlarge on step three is through 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11. He didn't take any of those. He just took 1, 2, and 3.
Now, to his consternation, he found himself drunk a half a dozen times in rapid succession. On each of these occasions, we worked with him, reviewing carefully what had happened.
These were good AA members. Old Jim got drunk 6 times in a row. Every time they went over to see him, carefully reviewing what had happened. You get drunk 6 times in a row today, they probably won't have anything to do with you. These guys were good AA members working with old Jim.
He agreed he was a real alcoholic and in serious condition. He knew he faced another trip to the treatment center if he kept on. Moreover, he would lose his family for whom he had deep affection. Yet he got drunk again. We asked him to tell us exactly what happened. This is his story.
They're getting a little tired of Jim now. And I said, my God, Jim, this is 7 times in a row you've been drunk. Let's don't go through this anymore. Sit down here and tell us just exactly how this happened.
This is his story. See, I came to work on Tuesday morning.
We read this book for years before we saw this. I came to work on Tuesday morning. Yeah. Where was he all day Monday, you know? We Alkies are bad about Mondays. Now, we're going to look in old Jim's mind. And we're going to see where he went from sane to insane thinking, from normal to abnormal thinking. We're going to see where he became insane.
He said, I remember I felt irritated that I had to be a salesman for concern I once owned.
I think that's probably perfectly normal. I think anybody in here that had to be a salesman for a concern that they once owned might be a little bit irritated by that fact also.
He said, I had a few words with the boss, but nothing serious.
Boss probably said, Jim, by the way, where were you all day yesterday anyhow? Nothing real serious, just kind of chewed him out a little bit.
Well, the heat's on at work. He said, I decided to drive into the country and see one of my prospects for a car.
Now, what's more normal than if you had a few words with the boss, you're a little irritated, you want to get away from the shop for a while, and apparently he's a car salesman, so he goes out into the country to see somebody he already knows to sell a car to. Normal, sane thinking for an alcoholic car salesman.
He said, on the way I felt hungry, so I stopped at a roadside place where they have a bar. I had no intention of drinking. I just thought I'd get a sandwich.
What's more normal than if you're hungry to stop in a place to get a sandwich? The fact that they have a bar there is beside the point. He has no intention of drinking. He's just hungry and going to get a sandwich. Normal, sane thinking for an alcoholic car salesman.
I also had the notion that I might find a customer for a car at this place, which was familiar, for I've been going to it for years. I'd eat there many times during the months I was sober.
So this is nothing new. We've been in this place many times since we were sober. We're not going in there to drink. We're going in there to get a sandwich and maybe find a customer for a car while we're in there. Normal, sane thinking for an alcoholic car salesman.
And sit down at a table and order a sandwich and a glass of milk.
What's more normal than if you're hungry to sit down at a table and order a sandwich and a glass of milk? Normal, sane thinking for an alcoholic car salesman.
Still no thought of drinking. Ordered another sandwich and decided to have another glass of milk.
Now, there's nothing wrong with 2 sandwiches and 2 glasses of milk if you're hungry enough. Unless you're a member of Overeaters Anonymous, then you better look at it closely. But that would be normal, sane thinking for an alcoholic car salesman. Now comes the squiggly writing.
He said, suddenly, that means right now. Suddenly, the thought crossed my mind that if I'd put an ounce of whiskey in my milk, it couldn't hurt me on a full stomach.
Now, this is absolute insanity for this alcoholic car salesman to think he can take whiskey and mix it with milk and it wouldn't hurt him on a full stomach. Now, based on the insane idea, he makes a decision and takes some action.
He said, I ordered whiskey and poured it into the milk. And I vaguely sensed I was not being any too smart. But felt reassured I was taking the whiskey on a full stomach.
Now then, we've got it inside ourselves. The physical allergy immediately takes over. And now then, we can't stop.
The experiment went so well, I ordered another whiskey and poured it into more milk. That didn't seem to bother me, so I tried another. That's about 4 or 5 glasses of milk now. You can imagine what's going on with him. Has anybody but me ever put some whiskey in the milk? Well, I have. What happens to it? Clabbers up, doesn't it? Well, if you put whiskey in, for you the new people who want to go back out and drink and try this, if you use 100% alcohol, so that blended whiskey, it won't clabber up. Or if you will use good Scotch whiskey, it won't clabber up. But that blended whiskey will cause it to clabber. That's what I'm trying to say. And everything inside you will clamber up too.
Are you through?
Yeah, I'm through.
Okay. Thus started one more journey to the treatment center for Jim. Here was a threat of commitment, the loss of family and position, to say nothing of that intense mental and physical suffering which drinking always caused him. He had much knowledge about himself as an alcoholic, yet all reasons for not drinking were easily pushed aside in favor of the foolish idea that he could take whiskey if only he mixed it with milk. Now, whatever the precise definition of the word may be, we call this plain insanity. How can such a lack of proportion of the ability to think straight be called anything else? Now, is old Jim's problem the fact that he has a physical allergy to alcohol? Or that he has a form of insanity that tells him it's okay to drink alcohol mixed with milk on a full stomach? The real problem centers in the mind, telling us we can drink, rather than the body that ensures that we can't drink. Let's go down to the bottom of page 37, last paragraph.
He said, our behavior is absurd and incomprehensible with respect to that first drink as an individual with a passion, say, for jaywalking. Now, he gets a thrill out of skipping in front of fast-moving vehicles.
I don't understand this guy at all. But I can see him standing out here by the side of the interstate, waiting for a big truck or a bus to come down through there. Jumps out in front of it, spins around 2 or 3 times, sees how close it can come to hitting him without actually hitting him. For some reason, he gets a thrill out of that. I don't understand him, but I can see him doing it.
He enjoys himself for a few years in spite of friendly warnings.
People are saying, hey, Jack, you better quit doing that. You're going to keep jumping out there and you're going to get hurt after a while. He doesn't pay a bit of attention to them.
Up to this point, you would label him as a foolish chap having queer ideas of fun. Luck then deserts him and he's slightly injured several times in succession.
He's getting a little older now. He can't move as fast. They begin to hit him once in a while. Nothing real serious. He just kind of bounces off of them.
Now, you would expect him, if he were normal, to cut it out. Presently, he's hit again, and this time he has a fractured skull.
He got hurt bad this time, yeah.
Within a week after leaving the hospital, a fast-moving trolley breaks his arm.
He gets hurt bad again. Now, he sings their national anthem. He tells you he's decided to stop jaywalking for good. He said, I'll never jaywalk again. As long as I live, I'm tired of these fractured skulls and broken arms, etc.
He tells you he decided to stop jaywalking for good. But in a few weeks, he breaks both legs. On through the years, his conduct continues accompanied by a continual promise to be careful or to keep off the streets altogether. Finally, he can no longer work.
He's just beat up now. He can't hold a job.
His wife gets a divorce and is held up to ridicule.
She's tired of supporting him and the kids and the hospital bills.
And he tries every known means to get the jaywalking idea out of his head.
Out of his head. Not out of his body, but out of his head.
And he shuts himself up in an asylum or treatment center. Well, they got him for everything else. They might as well have him for jaywalking. Hoping to mend his ways. But the day he comes out, he races in front of a fire engine, which breaks his back. Such a man would be crazy, wouldn't he? Now, you may think our illustration is too ridiculous, but is it? We've been through the ringer, have to admit we substituted alcoholism for jaywalking, and the illustration would fit us exactly. However intelligent we may have been with other respects, where alcohol has been involved, we've been strangely insane. It's strong language, but isn't it true?
Now, some of you are thinking, yes, what you tell us is true, but it doesn't fully apply. We admit we have some of these symptoms. We've not gone to the extremes you fellas did, nor are we likely to. For we understand ourselves so well after what you've told us that such things cannot happen again. We've not lost everything in life through drinking. We certainly do not intend to. Thanks for the information. I think that is so appropriate today. Again, because of education, many, many people are getting to AA before they have to lose everything. And we see somebody come in here sometimes that's still got a job. Sometimes they come in and are still married. I saw a guy come in the other day, and hell, he still had an automobile. And we start talking to them about the insanity thing, and they say, oh man, don't tell me I'm crazy. I'm not like you guys. I haven't lost my job. I still got my family. I'm driving a good car. You know, I'm a respected member of the community, but I appreciate the information that you give me. Thank you. We call those kind of people sometimes a high-bottom drunk. Jim was a low-bottom drunk. Jim lost everything that he had, and he had to be a salesman for a concern that he once owned. But many people come to us today, and they haven't really lost anything, but they're still alcoholic. We call them high-bottom drunks or high-bottom alcoholics. And a high-bottom drunk...